That's a mariachi band from Milwaukee. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. What does it mean to be Latinx in the Midwest? How do we know when to say Chicano, Mexican-American, Latino, Latina, or Latinx? And why does what people call themselves matter? My guest is Teresa Delgadillo, UW-Madison Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor and Chair of the Chicanexa and Latinxi Studies Department. She is the co-founder of Latinx Talk and the author of books such as Latino Lives in Milwaukee, Building Sustainable Worlds, Latinx Placemaking in the Midwest, Spiritual Mestiza, Religion, Gender, Race, and Nation in Contemporary Chicana Narrative, and Geographies of Relation, Diasporas and Borderlands in the Americas. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Happy I think I here. Mispronounced that new department name. Can you tell me the name of the department you're now chair of?
Actually, I'm the director of the Chicanxa and Latinxa Studies Program. We are not yet a department. We would like to be someday, and certainly that's what students demanded when they fought for this program 50 years ago. So we're hoping that someday that will happen soon.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own background and journey to becoming now the director of this program on campus and someone who has published books on Latina lives in Milwaukee or Chicana narratives or different aspects of being Latino?
Sure. I have always been deeply interested in the cultural production of Mexican-American and Latinx communities, which is the communities that I come from and that I've been familiar with. And I've always been, I think, as I was growing up, a little disappointed that I didn't encounter that in my education in school, or that I encountered what were narratives that perpetuated a view that didn't take into account these communities or populations. So that was always a curiosity and an interest for me as I was growing up and realizing what was there, what wasn't there. And I think that I wasn't entirely convinced that I could study this or do this until Oscar Ijuelos published his first novel, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. And I saw that novel displayed on a bookshelf in New York in a bookstore. And it was a feature, so the whole bookshelf was featuring. I think it may have been the first Latinx novel to win the Pulitzer Prize. And that was like, oh, okay, now that's a mark of acceptance. Now you can actually study and do this. I mean, obviously people were studying it before that point, but that's what prompted me to return to school and actually develop an expertise beyond what I knew myself from my own study in learning about literature and visual culture of Latinx communities across the United States.
You mentioned about the way things are taught in the schools, and I feel personally coming out, and this is coming out of Madison West High and UW-Madison in different ways, that it's a big gap in my own education. First of all, in middle school and high school, I was steered into taking French, German, and Old English in graduate school, not Spanish, as if it somehow wasn't as highfalutin as the other languages for someone who wanted to go on in graduate school. And then with history, you know, yes, we did some things about the Civil War and Martin Luther King and so on, but the whole story of the Mexican-American war or different things having to do with territory, that seemed to be left out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of that was left out. We certainly didn't cover that much of it in our social studies courses. And we didn't study any of the literature. I mean, I remember, you know, like as a young woman, I was working and I had friends who they knew about Aristeo Brito's work, or they knew about Rivera's work. And so they would exchange these, you know, mimeograph copies or Xerox copies of the novels that we knew about, but certainly no systematic study of this in any way. And I think there is definitely more of that. Of the literature being included in more K through 12 schools, but there's still quite a bit that isn't there.
What was your own family story in terms of either immigration or already being here, but having people assume that you were immigrants?
My parents were immigrants, and so we always were aware of that, and we spoke Spanish at home, and then quickly began to learn English. And we grew up here, so we learned English, and our parents then also began to learn English, and so that that sense of always being having a unique identity was definitely true throughout my education I grew up in Milwaukee, so that was definitely true, and not only true of me, but a number of people. I interviewed women for the Latina Lives in Milwaukee project, and also interviewed a lot of people for our Building Sustainable Worlds project throughout the Ohio in that case. And quite a few people express that feeling of like, oh, there's just a few of us, or oh, there were just some of us in the school while we were growing up. And so that was definitely a common experience.
I know there's a book that Oscar Morales wrote called I Didn't Know There Were Latinos in Wisconsin, Three Decades of Hispanic Writing. And he has a poem, Lost and Found Language. I'm just going to read a little of it and then see if what you think. It started in 1949 when my oldest brother came home from school in Racine, Wisconsin, after flunking kindergarten because he spoke no English, and declared to my parents that the rest of the kids have to learn to speak English if we planned on staying here in the United States. So my parents lined up the rest of the seven younger children, had us straighten up, tilt our heads back, reached in our mouth with their hands, and took turns slicing our tongues in half, making a simple but unspoken contract that from then on the parents would speak Spanish and the children would respond back only in English. How do you lose a native language? Does it get misplaced in the recesses of your brain, or does it never quite stick to the sides of your mind?
Yeah, that's a really lovely poem from Oscar Mireles. And that collection, that anthology, is one of the first anthologies. He first put together an anthology that was Xeroxed and bound together, very very much a self-publication effort of writers when he was in Milwaukee, and I was just, I think, starting graduate school at the time. So that was really an impressive collection of work that addressed what it meant to grow up as Mexican American or Latinx in the Midwest, what that meant for what we were allowed to do or what you had to do, and ways that people worked to make their lives work in this particular region, and to make known. I think a big part of that project was to make known the existence of a Latinx population in the Midwest. I think, and this is interesting because up until the 90s, much of the focus on Mexican American, Puerto Rican, Puerto Riqueño, and Latinx populations was coastal. Oh, that's a West Coast population, or that's an East Coast population, or maybe that's a Southwest population. There's very little recognition, both in the popular discourse and in academic scholarship, of the long existence of this population in the Midwest region. So some work begins to emerge in the 1990s from scholars like Dennis Valdez or Zaragoza Vargas, who are writing about the labor history of Mexican-American laborers in the Detroit auto plants or in the packing houses and agricultural fields of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, Ohio. So we begin to get a sense then of the wealth of that presence, that long-standing presence in the region, and we begin to develop a body of scholarship around it in the 1990s. And that area of scholarship has really grown quite a bit. I'm glad to have contributed to it with these projects, but I have many colleagues as well who are contributing to creating the knowledge and sharing the knowledge of the history and arts and cultures and experiences of the multiple Latinx populations that have long made up the Midwest region, and that we haven't always recognized as having been a part of this region for well over 100 years.
Yeah, you're right, because when I think of Latino populations, I think of Miami or San Antonio or, you know, San Diego or somewhere like that. I don't really think of the Midwest. And so it's, I can see why Oscar entitled his anthology, "I Didn't Know There Were Latinos in Wisconsin." I mean, it's kind of a, he, of course he knew, but just how much was out there is what you're saying.
Well, let's talk that was something that I, when I went away to graduate school in California, it was one of the things I heard most often when I introduced myself. People would say, after I introduced myself, "Oh, I didn't know there were Latinos in Wisconsin," or "I didn't know there were Mexicanos in Wisconsin." So it was a very common thing to have heard. Less so now. Less so now.
Well, let's talk about language, because terms matter, and they're shifting, they're changing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, many people are afraid they're going to say the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. So we've got Latino, and that's Latino, Latina, Latinx now. Mm-hmm. We have Hispanic. We have Mexican-American or Puerto Rican. You know, we have all kinds of different things. Sometimes the term mestiza comes in. It did in the title of one of your books. Talk to me about the language. Mm-hmm. What is accurate and why does it matter?
It's always important, in my view, to use the terms by which people describe themselves. And I think it's always important to try to be aware of how people describe themselves rather than ascribing to them an identity or a name that doesn't ring true for them. And so there has been quite an evolution in the terms that we use, and a proliferation in the terms that are common in our field and that are common among the populations that we study. And that is due to a couple of different things. One, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the more progressive and radical young Mexican Americans who fought for extending civil rights to Mexican American populations, who fought for farm worker rights, who fought for equality in education, they adopted the term Chicano as a term that identified that generation and its demands.
So Chicano, would that have been associated, for example, with Cesar Chavez?
Yes. Yeah, that would have very much associated with a movement for equal recognition.
And what is the origin of the term?
Like,
what
is Chicano? There's lots of debate on the origin of the term. And there's lots of debate about it being a derogatory term that was formerly used, or it having come from a slight variation of indigenous words. So there's not clarity on the origins of the word. But it certainly became a label of pride and self-identification and empowerment in the 1970s. And that has extended forward. It has never lost that sense, those senses of that it signals an empowered and self-aware identity of someone who believes that they have equal rights within the United States. Women who were always a part of the movement and began to be more vocal about the right for equal gender rights within the movement as well as without the movement, slightly modified that to include women. Ah, in Spanish, the O is the masculine and the A is the feminine. And so they added the A, Chicana, and began using Chicana. And so very often people would use Chicanao. And formerly, our program name here at UW-Madison, that was the name that we had up until this year, was Chicanao. It was the A and the O.
Or before that, it would have been Chicano Studies.
Before that, it was Chicano, just the O. So the addition of the A recognized that the population wasn't only masculine, but also feminine, that included all genders, and so we wanted our name to reflect that. And Latino, Latina became much more common in the 1990s as a term that spoke to all people of Latin American descent in the United States, not only Mexican Americans, which Chicano is Mexican American. So the Latino term became an umbrella term that encompassed all of the different subgroups, like Mexican American, Puerto Rican, Dominican American, Colombian American, Ecuadorian American, Salvadoran American. So all of those groups are included in that large umbrella term of Latina, which is the feminine, Latino, the masculine, and Latinx, which is currently much in use to be gender inclusive of all genders, and an easier way than the AO, rather than saying Latina AO, Latinx.
Latinx and
or Latine is the new version that many younger people are using.
And so that would really refer to place rather than necessarily language, although almost all would have Spanish. In other words, could you have a South American country that speaks Portuguese but is Latino?
These terms refer to people who are in the U.S., who are residents and citizens of the United States, who exist as a population in the United States. So all of these terms refer to...
Could it be someone who is from a region in South America that does not speak Spanish as its primary language?
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, one of the things that we found in our study of the Latino and Latina ethnic festivals in Ohio, a study we did in 2017, and we wrote about that in the Building Sustainable Worlds book, we found that there were quite a few Brazilians who identified themselves as Latinx, who participated in these festivals and events alongside their peers from other Latin American heritages, and absolutely viewed themselves in that way.
I think I know we're going to be talking more about some of the recordings you did in Milwaukee of Latina women, but I think you also have a recording of a man at one of those festivals who is talking about identity and names. Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little of that.
Okay.
What actually happened to us? We're supposed to be extinct, but we're still here.
Yeah.
We're not extinct as long as our ancestors are still with us.
On every single one of my stats, I put one little slogan, 1492, still here.
Yeah. And it's so important.
Yeah.
Because my dad would always take us to, like, the powwows in California, because you can't lose that, you know?
You can't lose that.
Yeah.
No.
You gotta keep teaching me on. Like I said, all three of my girls dance.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
do you guys kind of push back against the Latino identity, or, like, being labeled as, like, Latino?
Latino is different than saying that you're Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Spanish were the conquerors.
Yeah.
And they brought the Inquisition to this part of the world.
Yep.
So Latino means that we identify, we know where we come from, and that our cultures are multiple cultures, not one culture.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, you look alike.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No, we don't.
And there's so much history there.
You know, it's interesting where they're talking about we're supposed to be extinct, but we're still here, and how they need to teach the young. And they are making it clear that the Spanish, that would be the conqueror. So So Latino does not mean people from Spain who never went through the experience of, you know, being oppressed. Is that how you interpret that?
Oh, right. So it's not right. It's not Spanish American, as in from Spain, right? It is someone from Latin American descendancy. And that... or that Latin American heritage. And they are making a point and a distinction between, because from sometimes, and I think part of what these two people are observing, who we interviewed at in Campbellsport, Ohio, at one of the Latinx ethnic festivals there, they were making the point that just calling people Spanish or identifying them as Spanish, it doesn't adequately identify who people are, because Spain is a country in Europe that exists apart from Latin America. And so they were really making that point about asserting their own identity as part of, they were saying, we're Latinx, And we're all very different. They were recognizing the multiplicity that that term encompasses, that it doesn't mean only one identity. It could be multiple different kinds of identity or national backgrounds or linguistic abilities or even indigenous or Afro-diasporic ethnic identities within that. And yet that umbrella term works for them as something to describe who they have most in common with.
It reminds me of how sometimes if somebody says you're African, how that does not acknowledge the multiplicity of cultures and languages and, you know, just religions, all kinds of things that go into that. And so you're saying that the term Latinx, that is wide-ranging, that there are commonalities, but there's also incredible differences. We're going to look at your work in Milwaukee when we continue in a moment on University of the Year.
Porque llegaron unas comadres que yo por las conoces, Budelia, Talavera y Evelia, Evelia Talavera, y llegaron allá a la casa donde yo vivía a arreglar sus pasaportes, sus, y pues me duraron como unos 3 meses ahí y yo me mucho con ellas, me encariñé y todo y luego pues no, y ahora sí me voy porque ya se van Evelia y Budelia. Vaya.
¿Y ellas eran comadres del pueblo, del rancho?
No, eran de otra parte.
Ajá.
De la, la había pero la, sí. Ah.
Y ellas ya sí.
That's from an interview with a Latina from Milwaukee in a collection that my guest, Teresa Delgadillo, has published about. I'm Emily Auerbach, and we are talking about what it means to be Latinx in the Midwest. Teresa, tell me about what she says in that interview and about this whole project of talking to Latina women in Milwaukee about their backgrounds.
The beginning of this project was one of those moments of realization that something that should have been there in my education wasn't. And I started this project because I had done an MFA and I was going to write fiction. And I wanted to write fiction about the places I knew. So I went to the Milwaukee County Historical Society on a little research trip, and I wanted to learn more about the history of Latinos and Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricanos in Milwaukee. And they brought out to me this little cardboard file box that was full of some odd photos, a few invitations, some flyers, an assortment of things that were really a jumble. They didn't exist in any categorized way. As a researcher, you know, if you go into an archive and you request a box of materials, usually what you're going to get is a box with really well-ordered items labeled in folders, what they are, they're identified, they're cataloged. And that wasn't the case here. And it really hit me then that there is no history of our presence in this city where people have been since the end of the 19th century. And I'm looking at this at the end of the 20th century, and there's nothing there. And that was terrifying that wasn't there. So that actually led me to this project, Latina Lives in Milwaukee, not fiction, but instead an oral history project that of capturing the stories and experiences of those who had made their lives in this city and contributed to it and built families there. And none of that was known. So that led me to look for interviewees, and it was sort of a snowball project. I had originally thought that I would interview all women who were my mother's age, that were older, who could tell us about that older history. And many of them were gone already, had passed away or had moved away.
Which shows the urgency of getting these stories down before it's too late.
Exactly. And so I decided instead to make it a multi-generational book, and it actually winds up covering history from essentially 1924 to 2015, through the lives, the stories of all these different women I interviewed. So chronologically, it moves us through the century, and it reveals a great deal of texture and detail to what life was like for the varied Mexican-American, Salvadoran, Puerto Ricanas who came to Milwaukee during that time period in these stories. And so that's where I started, and that's what I wanted to get. And I'm really delighted that all of these women were willing to collaborate with me and to share their stories, not only for me, but for a wider public, and also willing to work with me on giving me feedback and the edits and the shaping of the narrative. And so I'm really grateful to all of them.
Well, I'm sure it was invaluable that you were bilingual and could interview some in Spanish, some in English, and that you had your own place there in Milwaukee with, you know, your mother and her family, and so that you were not an outsider sort of poking around with a condescending attitude.
Well, I wouldn't say that I was an insider at that point, because that was one of my hesitations. I lived away from Milwaukee for a few decades by then. So yes, I had connections and I was still home and I visited often, but there was a lot I didn't know. So for me, it was also a humbling experience to learn more about things that I didn't know about and couldn't possibly have known about.
We opened with a little bit in Spanish. What was she saying about her journey to Milwaukee?
Yes, that's Ramona Arciniega, and she is the wife of Jesus Arciniega. And I should say, you know, Jesus Arciniega was a U.S. citizen. His parents were Mexican. They worked in agriculture and then wound up moving from California to Wisconsin. And they were in Wisconsin when Jesus's parents were deported in the 1954 deportations. Many people don't realize that there was a deportation campaign in 1954.
I didn't know that.
As well.
So what triggered that deportation campaign?
That I'm not sure about. It was called Operation Wetback.
Ooh.
And Mexicans were rounded up and were deported. Jesus went back with his parents. He was a U.S. citizen. He went back and forth between Mexico and the United States for a number of years before he met his wife in Mexico. And then he was already, at the time of this interview, he's already working in Milwaukee. He'd returned and was working in Milwaukee. And they were married, he and Ramona. But Ramona wasn't eager to move to Milwaukee or to the U.S. She liked living in Mexico. And in this little snippet, she describes, so I'm living in my house in Monterrey, and these two women, Avelia and Gudelia, Talavera, they arrive. They're acquaintances of acquaintances, and they come to stay with us while they're waiting for their visas to be approved so that they can move to Milwaukee and join their husbands. And they stay with them for about 3 months, and at the end of the 3 months, they have become such fast friends that Ramona decides, now I'll move. Now I'll migrate because I know I'm going to have a network of women friends who are going to be there too, and we can support each other. And so they do all come, and they do remain lifelong friends.
That really shows the value of community.
That's really important. It does. It speaks to the fact that even people who seemingly are migrating by themselves are actually not by themselves. You're traveling with people. You're relying on other people in the journey. You're meeting other people in the journey. You're creating, of necessity, creating bonds of support. And that story really makes that evident, the way that people do support each other through these processes.
You mentioned that your book, Latina Lives in Milwaukee, was multi-generational in its approach. And there's a family, the Sandovals, where you interview several at the same time, I think. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that family? And then maybe we can listen to a clip from that interview.
Yes. The Sandoval sisters I interviewed, Elvira Gloria, Margarita, and Rosemary. They are a family of four, and they have two brothers as well that they spoke about in the interview. They came, their parents came, their father had been in Milwaukee in the early 20th century and went back to Mexico because he was ill and had to rest. And so he went there to rest and then met his wife, and then he came back to Milwaukee and with their mother, Elvira Sandoval, and they built a family here. They had the four girls and two boys. And their father was a musician, and so he played with a band that was well-known in Milwaukee, part of the social scene and entertainment scene for Mexican and Mexican-American community that was small but growing in the early 20th century and through the mid-20th century. So they talk a lot in the interview about that influence of learning instruments, of singing and performing with their father. And they also speak a lot about the shifts that they experienced as they were growing up from their neighborhood, the original neighborhood where they were living, to purchasing a house and was then mostly a white neighborhood, and entering schools where there were only few Latinos or other Mexican Americans. And the ways that they also met and learned to work with other Latinx communities, like Puerto Ricanos, in Milwaukee, that was important and an important thing for them to engage in for the success of the community.
Let's listen to a bit from an interview where they talk about all the children loving their heritage and hating to leave the neighborhood.
Did you girls know why we moved away from 6th Street?
Tell us, Gloria. Well, I'll tell you something. There was a lady that we had the front home, didn't we, Elvis? And then the owner of the property lived in the back in a cottage, and she was an older lady. I don't know how old, but she had gray hair already, I say. And she probably was a little disorientated or perhaps a little mentally sick. I don't know. But Elvira and I were out there cleaning the house. We had little buckets and we had little brushes, and we were washing her house down with water. She became she became very angry when she came out. She thought we were painting the house. And here we were painting with water. And she scolded Elvira, and she grabbed Elvira by the neck and shook her and tried choking her. That was it. I don't think we lasted more than 2 weeks there. And, you know, we sort of hated to leave that neighborhood. Because right next door was Cardenas grocery store. And we loved going there because Mercedes, who we call Madrina, our godmother, was godmother to Elvira. And she wasn't to me, but I call her Madrina also. And we go in there and we could pick out our penny candy for nothing. The boys would spoil us, lift us up, swing us, do this and that. And we were nicknamed. Elvira was called El Gallo because she was the leader and I was the follower, so I was the pato. And they would say, aquí viene el gallo y el pato.
They're really generous in this interview in recognizing that the landlady who lives behind them may have had other issues going on. But that incident really speaks to the kinds of lack of familiarity or hostility and potentially violence that immigrants experienced in a really small, really condensed way. It conveys a little bit of that. And their parents' reaction to it, immediately we're moving somewhere else, made super sense. It's a really nice contrast to what they also describe, which is the sense of belonging and home and a companionship that they felt with the Cardenas family, who had the grocery nearby in that neighborhood. So there's a contrast there between not being accepted, not being wanted, being, you know, threatened, and having this community of people who do see you and recognize you and appreciate who you are. And it's a really nice illustration of that dichotomy that so many Latinx communities face, have always faced in moving to this region and continue to face today, that dichotomy of experience of on the one hand being unfamiliar, hostile, or threatening to some, and on the other hand of existing in a community with others who appreciate, value you, and support you.
Just a few weekends ago, I was in Minnesota. My son plays in the Minnesota Orchestra, and they had one number where they involved seven states of Mexico folklore dancing, folk dancing, to go with the music that was on stage. And, you know, talked about in the introductory remarks that the costumes were different for each of the different seven regions. And so that, you know, just the variety there. You mentioned music and dance. Is that, you know, one of the big ways that if you're in Milwaukee and you want to get together as a Latinx community, that that takes place?
At that time, that was a big way to get together, bailes. And I'm sure so that has grown. That's multiplied in terms of what's available now for ways for people to get together and experience community together. And certainly the festivals are part of that. But I think that what you mentioned about your son's experience of the variety of regional expression within Mexico was also visible to us, to the group that I was researching with in 2017 at the Ohio Latinx Festivals. We went to the Springfield Festival, and they actually, for the Latino Festival, all of the food booths were from, there were a couple from different countries, so they had a Honduras and a Venezuela booth, but they had, from Mexico, they had multiple regions of Mexico. So one booth would be from Veracruz, one booth would be from Oaxaca, one booth would be from Michoacán. They featured the cuisines of the different regions at each of the booths. And that was an effort to convey to the audience attending the festival, which is mixed. It wasn't only Latinos, but also the local Anglo-American population, those predominant at that church, that the multiplicity and heterogeneity of Mexico and of these countries in Latin America, that to educate people about the diversity within a nationality and a national ethnic group. But also, it was my colleague Claire Fox at University of Iowa wrote about this in our book as well, the Building Sustainable Worlds project. She wrote about hospitality and the ability of the guest to reciprocate the hospitality is really important. And she spoke about many of the gatherings that she witnessed in Hampton, Iowa, as that kind of reciprocity, as the festival as a way of reciprocating and sharing in a way that establishes a more equal relationship. One is not only a taker, one is also giving. And I thought that was a really interesting take on what animates in for some the festival, the Latinx ethnic festival, and what it's able to do in educating people and sharing and showing hospitality to others as well.
The same family, the Sandoval family, also talked to you about changing gender roles, kind of how they were as wives and how their own children were. Let's listen to a little bit of that, and then you can talk about what that added to your study.
And we wait hand and foot on our husbands.
Totally. I mean, our husbands are the most spoiled men. Yeah, they love it. All of our husbands.
And so you don't feel at all defensive or bad about that, like, oh, that's not, you know.
Now, our children, it's a different story.
Totally a different story.
Or it's a different story.
We raised our children to be independent. Mm-hmm. We raised our children
to function. Yeah. Totally.
So cook, clean, function, separate.
The boys and the girls.
Absolutely. My voice.
So for our children, there isn't one spouse that caters to the other.
It is all equal. And that was important to you, to teach both of them. both the boys and the girls, I mean. That.
Oh, you, yes, absolutely. Because I knew that this was not going to continue. That my sons will never find a wife that will work as hard as I did. Mm-hmm. Never, mm-hmm. never. Mm-hmm. And they are so appreciative. Mm-hmm. And their wives are so appreciative. Mm-hmm.
That you did that.
Yes. And they laugh at me now when I would tell them we're going to do ironing shirts 101. And they were in seventh grade. We do laundry. One son did whites every night. One son did black every night. We're going to do cooking 101. And what are we going to make? Open up the recipe book. You pick. Mm-hmm. You now know how to read. So now we're going to cook it. Mm-hmm. They are so happy.
That's really fascinating that they can identify both how much they add as sort of more traditional wives and how happy that makes their husbands and their children, how spoiled it makes them, but also acknowledging that it's not going to be the same in the next generation, that their sons are not going to find wives like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I thought it was a really interesting point in our conversation because all of the Sandoval sisters are professional women and have been counselor, librarian, business owner, and real estate agent. And so they all had professional lives in addition to their family lives, which was not true of their mother. Their mother worked at home and took care of them. And she trained them in how to be wives, and they cherish that training and are happy for it. But they do convey the dynamism of social and cultural change in this section of the interview when they recognize that the next generation of young men and women aren't being raised in the same way and shouldn't be raised in the same way, that they need to have greater independence, and women need to be relieved of the double burden of housework, care for children, and career that many of them, that women are often saddled with. So it's a really interesting recognition of, and I think it speaks to the ways that, you know, populate Latinx communities don't just exist. They're strong communities, right? They support each other. But they don't exist just in isolation from anything else that's happening in the world. They are completely involved in everything else that's happening in the world. So movements for greater equality for women and for greater support for women are part of what they are also experiencing and wanting to prepare their children for that, you know, to live in a world that is more equal. I think it's really interesting that they also mention and talk about, and they're not the only ones, I think a couple other interviews also mention strikes. Their fathers are working in industries that we often hear today this discourse of, oh, we want to get back to those good, well-paying industrial jobs. And it's really interesting to me what emerged through those interviews and also what emerges in Latinx literature about those old good-paying jobs, because they were never given to workers simply because of who they were. The Sandoval sisters described their father having been on strike at three different times for several months at a time and the kind of hardships that created for the family. So that good-paying job did not come without a fight. And that good-paying job also did not always provide a healthy or safe environment. For example, in Western Avenue and Other Stories by Fred Arroyo, he talks about the toll that both agricultural and industrial labor takes on the body, and describing the Puerto Rican migrants that whose work he's talking about. But we see this also in Hugo Martinez Cero's stories, The Last Laugh and Other Stories. One of the main stories is about a character who grows a milpa on abandoned railroad land in South Chicago. And that story is set in the mid-20th century. And that abandoned railroad land is also used by other Mexican migrants to grow what are community gardens. They're growing family gardens in this abandoned railroad land. And the milpa is a practice, a traditional inherited from indigenous background, of permaculture, of growing corn, beans, and squash together because they feed each other and they grow well. And he's describing this, the story is describing this process of creating milpa in this abandoned railroad land. And part of what is animating the main character and his sons, who he's training in how to do this, is a desire to help them to see other opportunities and to create more opportunities for them, because he doesn't want them to work in the steel mill. The words of his foreman keep ringing in his head, who says, "Jose," I think it's something like, "Jose, one day your sons are going to work for me too." And so he doesn't experience the steel mill like as, you know, a healthy environment for his children. He really wants to try to shield them from it.
We're going to talk about generational change and also the toll that discrimination, deportation, and insults can take on a family.
I'm mixed.
When
I'm
we continue
Latino
the moment
American.
With university.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I don't really feel any difference, but I definitely feel camaraderie around them.
Yeah.
So I feel like I could go through different groups because I'm still in high school.
Yeah. Okay.
So I try to involve myself in everybody.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
That's some remarks recorded by my guest, Teresa Delgadillo, as she's working on Latinx in the Midwest. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with University of the Year. It is complicated to look at the many different peoples that identify as Latinx and to, just to get a sense of the range right here in the Midwest. What would you say are the biggest misconceptions where people, you mentioned that someone in California didn't know there even were any, you know, Latinos in the Midwest, but what kind of stereotypes and kind of insulting comments have you heard over the years of doing this research or living yourself as a Latina in the Midwest? For example, I've had students in my Odyssey program where someone has come up to them and said, "Stop speaking Mexican," or "Go back to where you came from," or, you know, it made them feel bad about who they are simply because they are speaking Spanish or because their skin is slightly darker or because they're, in one case, an indigenous woman from Ecuador.
Mm. Well, I guess the assumption that someone who is speaking a language other than English isn't from here is an interesting one. We live in such a monolingual country. I think that's probably a common misconception that there aren't multiple languages that aren't inherently a part of what the United States is. First of all, think of the indigenous languages that are native to these lands, but also the Spanish language was incorporated, Spanish language speakers were incorporated into the United States with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848. And that treaty, by the way, is one that guarantees that all those who now become U.S. citizens by virtue of the treaty, which is everyone in California, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, parts of Colorado and Oklahoma, would have their language rights respected, their property rights respected, and their religious rights respected. So it is definitely an odd assumption. I think one of the things that is also really striking, though, is the assumption that Latinx are a new population or new to the Midwest. The first interview I do on Latino lives in Milwaukee is with Antonio Morales, whose father came here in 1924, 1925, and then they came with their mother in 1926. There certainly is documentation of Latinx residents in Milwaukee and Wisconsin in the late 19th century, though I think in the main, the larger migration happens in the early 20s. as the Mexican Revolution is unfolding and people are fleeing war and uncertainty and the violence of that transformational change, which is also a transformational change for working people and the landless in Mexico.
Can you talk about the sort of the racial complications that come? I had a student from El Salvador in the Odyssey program living here in Madison who said she thought of herself as white and was called brown. And there, you know, when you are filling out various forms, there's all these boxes like Hispanic, non this, and, you know, just the there's the region you're from, and then there's this ethnicity and the kind of overtones of racism that can come into discourse as well. Can you talk about Latino populations and the question of race?
Well, as that young man describes it, the excerpt that opened this section, he is both Black and Latinx, and he embraces both of those identities. And he is a product of different ethnic groups intermarrying, and that we see a lot with Latinx populations in the U.S. I mean, Latinx people are meeting and falling in love with all kinds of people in the United States and marrying them and having families. And so that's definitely true. It is also true that among Latinx populations, there's a great deal of racial diversity. And as we spoke about before, ethnic diversity. So these are diverse populations. There are lighter skinned, there are darker skinned, Black, and there are Afro-Latinos who embrace and are proud of their African diaspora heritage, and as well as indigenous Latinos who are proud of their indigenous Latinx heritage. And so that umbrella term really encompasses all of that heterogeneity and multiplicity. And Latinos are not unique from other populations in that they're exempt from racist ideas. I mean, that racist ideas circulate the entire globe, and all kinds of people have racist ideas and racist conceptions of others. So it is as much a challenge for us to combat racist ideologies as it is for any other population.
And in 2025, lots of evidence of racism and deportations again. In just a few seconds, what would you say to anyone listening about what's important to know about Latinx in the Midwest or anywhere?
One of the things that I've learned through the research I did for these two projects was that this moment of increased hostility, of increased deportations against Latinx communities is not new. Those histories are, as we spoke about at the very beginning of this interview, aren't very well known. They should be more known. We should be teaching people about them so that we can learn from our history rather than repeat that history. And I think that's really important.
Teresa Delgadillo, thank you for the work you've done, and thank you for being with me here on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.